From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois' state government and politics.
Now, the former chief of staff to Michael Madigan, when he was the Illinois House Speaker, is now on trial in federal court. Tim Mapes is accused of perjury and obstructing justice. Prosecutors say he lied to a grand jury. We will hear more about the first week of his trial. Of course, Madigan set to go to trial next year on racketeering charges. We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, professor emeritus and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. Our guest this week, Dave McKinney, a reporter for WBEZ. And Dave, always good to have you back with us.
Sean, thanks for having me.
And also with us, we have Greg Hines, politics reporter and columnist for Crane Chicago Business. And Greg, good to have you back with us as well.
Ditto, sir.
So, Charlie, you've been off on vacation for a few weeks, so I'll give you first shot at this morning. We had some breaking news, so we want to start with that. The Illinois Supreme Court, in a narrow decision, upheld the state's assault weapons ban. I guess not a big surprise, but what did you glean from taking a look at the opinion this morning?
One of the things that I think was surprising, everyone expected that because the justices, all of them elected, five were elected as Democrats, two elected as Republicans. Everyone expected that, well, the Democrats will vote for this to uphold this law, the Republicans will dissent, and it would be 5-2. Actually, though, it was 4-3. And the one Democrat who dissented from the majority opinion was Justice Mary Kay O'Brien, and her argument was interesting in that she said that the majority erred in holding that the way the law breaks out certain categories of individuals who are allowed to have these types of weapons, law enforcement personnel, retired police officers, members of the military. She argued that the classification did not further the plain purpose of the bill. And she pointed out, exempting professionals and grandfather groups does nothing to prevent the proliferation of out-of-state assault weapon possession or prevent those weapons from being used for mass shootings in this state or elsewhere. The legislation does not prevent weapon manufacturers, some located within this state, from continuing to sell assault weapons and LCMs, large capacity magazines, to out-of-state residents who may then potentially perpetrate a mass shooting. Because 60% of the weapons used in crimes in Illinois come from out of state, the legislation does not further its purported goal of reducing the number of weapons in the state. So she dissented from the majority opinion based on her analysis that this really doesn't, allowing some people who've already have these weapons to continue to possess them and other groups of people to still acquire them, it really doesn't further the purpose of trying to do away with these kinds of shootings. And it was also interesting because the Republican dissenters, the two Republicans, Justice Lisa Holder White wrote the dissent. She was joined by Justice Dave Overstreet, said that they didn't want to get into the questions about whether it was violated the equal protection. They said a more fundamental issue was that the way this bill was passed, this law became, got through the General Assembly, violated the constitutional requirement that a bill be read three separate days. And it reminded me of maybe the most interesting one was years and years ago, and you guys will remember this, when the legislature was providing money for the White Sox, and the bill passed the House on the final day of session, and everyone thought that the Sox were going to Tampa Bay because the bill passed by everybody's clock at 3 minutes after midnight, at which point it would have required a 3/5 majority rather than a simple majority. But the then presiding officer in the House, Representative Jim McPike from Alton, said that the time is 11:59. And when it got to the court, the Supreme Court said, well, if the speaker said it was 11:59, that's all that counts. And so the dissenters in this case, the Republican elected judges, are arguing that we should do away with that. We should actually make the legislature adhere to what the Constitution requires. So those are basically my takeaways. Another interesting thing I should point out is that the majority opinion makes the point that they say we express no opinion on the potential viability of plaintiffs' waived claim concerning the Second Amendment. That suggests to me that this particular decision by the Illinois Supreme Court, in a way, it's not going to be significant in the long haul as to whether or not this particular law remains in effect. There is a challenge ongoing in the federal courts, and that obviously deals with the Second Amendment. That is the one that's going to be ultimately dispositive of this legislation.
And Greg, I guess you would agree with that, the federal courts where this is going to be decided one way or the other?
Yeah, I don't think there's much doubt about that, Sean. I think Charlie has a good point. Personally, I'm glad they upheld this law. I don't think there's any reason for people to be running around with weapons that are clearly entitled to, fully intended to shoot lots of people on the battlefront. But this is a tremendously complicated and controversial issue at the federal level. And I think the fact that one of the Democratic justices in Blue, Illinois dissented is really interesting and potentially significant. This thing could well have problems in the federal courts where Republican justices on occasion don't seem to have much reason to throw out stuff like that. They just believe you have a right to carry a gun, period. And Justice O'Brien has amplified that a little bit.
And Dave, I get your takeaway on this as well.
The majority opinion was written by Elizabeth Rochford, and you know, both Rochford and O'Brien, who was the dissenter that Greg is talking about, both of them had elections last year. And I think, you know, this is an opinion that shows once again that elections have consequences, because had Republicans picked up both of those seats, this opinion might have gone just completely opposite the way it did. So, you know, that's a takeaway right there. I think, like others have said at this point, this is going to play out at the federal level. You know, and we know the appetite of the U.S. Supreme Court for the Second Amendment and upholding the Second Amendment. And I don't think that, you know, the gun rights people, you know, look at this as a major, major setback for their efforts, because I think they know they've got a lot of viable ways to try to kill this in other venues.
Well, this will be an issue we will continue to follow, of course, breaking news as we sit down to record this show with this Supreme Court decision. Once again, Illinois Supreme Court narrowly deciding in favor and upholding the state's assault weapons ban. Well, let's move on to federal court on a different case. And Dave, you've been in court this week. Tim Mapes, he is the former chief of staff to the former Illinois House Speaker, Michael Madigan. He is on trial. So set up here what exactly the charges are against Mapes, and what did we learn in the first few days of his trial?
Well, Mapes was hauled in front of a federal grand jury back in 2021, and that was at the point when the feds were really developing their bribery investigation against ComEd and former House Speaker Michael Madigan, who was, as many of your listeners will recall, Mapes' boss. And the feds were very interested in learning what Tim Mapes knew about kind of the internal workings of the Madigan inner sanctum. And they knew that Mapes was close to Madigan. They knew that Mike McClain, the former ComEd lobbyist convicted last spring in the ComEd bribery trial, they knew that the two of them were the ones most likely to understand better than anybody else how Madigan thought, what, you know, the way he communicated to people, the way he issued orders and made decisions and communicated them to people. And so they wanted to get at Tim Mapes for that. And what the feds say, what they said in a two-count indictment against Mapes was that he lied in front of this grand jury, that he, to seven different questions that were trying to probe what exactly was Madigan's relationship with McClain? What kind of sensitive assignments was Madigan giving McClain, you know, to carry out? To all of those questions, Mapes either said he couldn't recall or he just didn't know. And so that's the heart of this. And that's really the argument that he was essentially lying. And what we've heard so far, and, you know, now we've had You know, the first couple of days were devoted to jury selection. So we've been in, you know, an open court now for two full days. And what we've heard are, just some very basic tutorials about how Springfield works, how the Madigan operation worked. There were, former House Majority Leader Greg Harris was on the stand for a while. State Representative Bob Rita, another insider there in the House, longtime House member. Both of them were called as prosecution witnesses. And what's very interesting in all of this is that, you know, one map was put up on the screen for jurors to look at, and it was a layout of Madigan's office suite. He's, you know, as people know who have been inside the Capitol, it's on the third floor. It overlooks the rotunda, and it's kind of a prominent piece of real estate in the State House. And inside there, they showed where Mapes's office was. They showed where Madigan's office was. And there was an empty conference room right next to Mapes's office, where you had to walk through in order to get into Mapes's office. And within that conference room, that's basically where McLean would set up shop and do a lot of his work while lobbying. I mean, that in itself was kind of unusual. Even though he and Madigan go back to their days as House members in the 1970s, just the idea that you have a single lobbyist setting up shop and doing his lobbying work within in a government office is peculiar enough. But I think what the point in that exhibit was to show that, how is it plausible that a guy like Mapes wouldn't know what McLean was up to, or wouldn't know what Madigan was wanting McLean to do? And so the feds are just beginning to build their case. I think next week when the trial really kind of will probably accelerate a little bit, we'll get a look at some of the grand jury testimony from Mapes and probably hear some recordings from him.
Greg, when it comes to Tim Mapes, those around the State House who have known him I think, as a meticulous type of fellow, a guy who is always very detail-oriented, what you would want, I would think, in a chief of staff if you were Mike Madigan. That's what you can tell the prosecutors are trying right now to set up, the fact that for him to forget things probably isn't as likely as maybe his defense team would let you believe. That seems to be where this case is headed right now.
Yeah, there's no question that Mapes was inside, and there's no question that he was the gatekeeper for the speaker. Bob Rita, who Dave referred to a minute ago, did kind of a visual demonstration. He drew a triangle up in the air, and Madigan's at the top, and the two other corners were Mike McLean and Tim Mapes. And his point was that, you know, this was the guy who ran the state party, State Democratic Party, for Madigan. This is the guy who ran the State House for Madigan. Of course he knew everything. Now, it looks like Mapes' defense is going to be, he's a doddering old guy. That happened a long time ago. Was in this very intimidating grand jury proceeding. And, he didn't remember. He said he didn't remember. He didn't remember. He didn't know, and whatever. How credible that's going to be, I don't know. I suspect that people who know the legislature well are going to kind of chuckle with that notion. But who knows how a jury is going to react? All I will say is not having watched the trial so far and not having read the indictment for a while. The feds have a pretty good track record in these kinds of cases. They usually win. But we'll find out.
Yeah, and Charlie, I mean, Mapes could face prison time over this, certainly. We talked about this on the show last week, but likely the way the feds tend to build their cases, if they can get a conviction here, they want to see if they can get that person to turn, and in this case would likely to see if he would turn on his old boss, Michael Madigan. So it seems to be just part of a typical federal government plan for how they're setting up for the Madigan trial next year. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's the case. I think from the feds' point of view, the best thing would be for Mapes to kind of throw up his hands and say, okay, you got me, I'll cooperate, what do you want me to do? Because if you recall, that was a cooperating witness was, I would argue, essential to getting the conviction against McLean, a couple other lobbyists, and an executive ComEd for the, what was called the ComEd bribery case. And so I'm guessing that's what the feds were hoping to do with Tim Mapes, get him to flip and say, well, yeah, here's the stuff I know. And on the other hand, as someone who was a doddering old guy, as Greg put it, I can kind of sympathize with him saying, well, or his attorney said he was asked like 650 questions, and there were seven of them that he didn't answer the way the feds hoped he would. I can kind of relate to the notion that, well, maybe you do forget things, because I do it all the time.
We are on State Week right now. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Dave McKinney of WBEZ, and Greg Hines with Crane Chicago Business. Before we move off of this trial of Tim Mapes, Dave, again, you're going to be in court watching this all the way to the end. Or have you gotten any indication so far that we're going to hear some new evidence in this entire corruption corruption scandal involving Michael Madigan? Are we going to hear something different in this that maybe we weren't aware of before?
You know, the feds keep their witnesses and evidence pretty close to the vest. I mean, you know, it's not unusual for the defense team to not know until, you know, the night before what the feds are planning the next day. So, I mean, it's pretty speculative to kind of go there. But I do think that there's a strong chance that among the recordings that the government will play, we probably will hear some conversations that involve McLean and Michael Madigan. And there won't be any conversations that involve just Madigan and McLean, Madigan and Mapes, I mean, because the feds, you know, were only taping McLean's phone. But you know, I think this is sort of a legal appetizer to the main event, the main meal next year with the Madigan trial, as you mentioned. And you know, I think that this case is a little bit different in that, you know, I don't know how this thing is going to break. I mean, Greg mentioned that you know, the Fed's batting average is high. Well, I mean, if you look at the data, it's usually it's a 90% plus conviction rate typically in that building. So I think that, you know, a guy like Tim Mapes knows that the odds are stacked very highly against him. And what I wonder if we will see is any more light shed on what motivated Mapes, if in fact he lied, to do that in front of a grand jury. And, you know, the Fed's argument is he was doing it to protect his old boss, and he didn't want the investigation into Madigan to proceed any farther than it had. And I'm just wondering if we're going to hear testimony or see any evidence that furthers that in some way, so we can understand better what motivation existed in Tim Mapes' mind to do allegedly what he did.
And before we move on here, Dave, and leave this topic, I think the thing people might wonder about is just how loyal is Tim Mapes. And it seems like, to do this, you know, if this is what has been alleged, he's a very loyal foot soldier for Michael Madigan.
Well, I think I don't think there's any doubt about that. And State Representative Rita, you know, told jurors that very thing, that Mapes was a loyal foot soldier for the speaker. And, you know, Mapes, in the legal situation that he finds himself in, if in fact, you know, he is convicted of lying, and if in fact he meant to do that, you know, it's a situation where, like, what an amazing sacrifice for someone, because, you know, Mapes, he was at the end of a very long career, granted, but, you know, he's with a conviction, he's going to go to federal prison, no doubt. Certainly unemployable. You know, the pension and the healthcare benefits that he accrued from decades of service in state government could be in question. You know, and that's a sacrifice that would hit not only him, but you know, both him and his wife. And then, you know, the cost of mounting a legal defense in a case like this. It's not unusual to see people spend $1 million. $2 million. And I don't know if that's what Mapes is having to spend here, but it's just an enormous burden for any defendant in that building, but particularly one in a high profile case like this to have to face. And so, you know, the price of loyalty, if that's what this was, you know, will be quite expensive to Tim Mapes if he's convicted.
Well, political watchers in Illinois were paying a lot of attention to Ohio this week. And the reason for that is the businessman Richard Uihlein from Illinois, known for backing some hard right candidates in the state. In fact, he backed Darren Bailey for governor last year. He was involved in a ballot question in Ohio. Greg, you were following this. What was the question all about, and then what happened with it?
There is pending in Ohio a referendum that will go to a vote in November that would include in the Constitution abortion rights. It would essentially protect the right to get an abortion. The Republicans don't like that, so they and the conservatives don't like that. So they sponsored another amendment that was voted on this week that would raise the threshold for approval of such a thing from a simple majority to 60%. And that's significant in Ohio because it looks like the 50% is there to enact abortion rights, but 60% is really questionable. Anyhow, it got put to a vote, and it went down pretty heavily, 57% to 43%. And what's interesting is that virtually all of the money that was spent on TV ads in favor of this proposal, $4 million of the $4.8 million, came from our own Dick Uihlein. Who is, as you correctly said, a conservative activist, a big spender. And this is certainly part of a pattern. Uihlein almost single-handedly funded Darren Bailey's campaign for governor last year, both in the general election and to some extent in a primary. He was a big backer of Bruce Rauner before he turned on Rauner and backed Jack Genie Ives. He has thrown through a bunch of PACs or other organizations run by Dan Proft, all kinds of money at state rep and in state Senate races, usually on the losing sides. And while he has every right to spend his money the way he wants, it's a free country, there are those who would say that, hey, you're actually hurting the party because you're getting behind such conservative people who are too far to the extreme, they can't win, that you're hurting the whole ticket and dragging it down. That certainly was the case in the last gubernatorial election here, where the Republicans, who didn't have much to start with, lost a couple House seats, they lost seats in the legislature, and they got killed for every state race, even though they had a couple attractive candidates down the ticket who could have won. But it's Uihlein's money. He's going to spend it the way he wants, and he's not interested in your opinion.
Now, Charlie, this is a person who he doesn't hold an elected office, but as Greg was pointing out correctly so, I mean, he really is behind this, in Illinois at least, this push toward more of the far right because he's got the money. He's got the resources to back somebody and elevate that candidate, and that's what's happened here. Well, meanwhile, a lot of more moderate Republican candidates were not able to get any type of traction because they didn't have those resources. Ken Griffin, of course, gone now from the state. Not sure if he'll be endorsing or even working with any of these candidates in the future. So right now, Uihlein is, I want to say, the face of the Republican Party in the state, but he plays a key role, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's certainly, you could argue that he is the main, funder of the current iteration of the Republican Party in Illinois. And As Greg said, he has the right to do with his money whatever he wants. You know, some millionaires or billionaires will use their money to buy a baseball team or a football team or to buy a newspaper or to try and eradicate malaria or to provide justice to Supreme Court justices, whatever they want. It's their money. They can do what they want. But unfortunately for Mr. Uihlein, the causes that he espouses tend to be out of touch with the sentiment of the vast majority of people, or at least enough majority to defeat his candidates in Illinois and apparently in Ohio as well. But as I say, it's his money, and if he wants to use it that way instead of, I don't know, buying himself some mountain retreat and becoming a hermit, that's his privilege. But as I say, and as Greg mentioned, his chances for success in Illinois are pretty slim because the Illinois voters just don't agree with the conservative principles that his candidates are espousing.
And we are awaiting a decision from Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson. He's expected soon to announce a new police superintendent. Greg, what do we know about that?
Well, what we know is that there's been a terrible crime problem in Chicago the last few years. It's gotten a little bit better the last couple of months, but it's still at, we're still at, way, at the levels way above what they were before the pandemic. It's causing all kinds of angst in the business community, which I cover. There's signs that some companies are leaving. They're having trouble recruiting people here. They don't want to come to dangerous Chicago. But anyhow, he has to pick his new general in the war on crime. The commission that nominates people has three candidates. All seem to be pretty well regarded here. The front runner is a guy named Larry Smelling, who heads the counterterrorism unit, but he's had a variety of jobs here, including district commander, which is the key thing. In theory, Mayor Jassett could say no to all three of these and ask the commission to send him new ones, but he has until Sunday to make his decision. It looks like he's going to pick one of these three, and like I said, Mr. Smelling is the front runner.
All right, let's go to our notes from the field, and Dave, let's go ahead and start with you.
Well, you know, the strange thing that I've noticed in covering this Mapes trial is, and, I mean, every defendant is different, and granted, every defendant has got enormous worries confronting them than something like this. But, you know, Mapes, I've talked to other reporters who are covering this as well. Mapes has got this unusual thing where it seems like he's sort of going out of his way to make eye contact or to have any interaction with anybody in the audience outside of family. And that includes reporters who have covered him for decades. And it's just the strangest thing. I mean, I was standing behind him in the lunch line and not a hello, not anything. And again, it doesn't bother me in any way, but it's just, I think what it shows is the dimension of stress that these people are all under. And it's certainly weighing on him.
All right, Charlie.
Well, the state reported that our cannabis sales in July totaled $140 million. That was the highest monthly total so far in 2023. And it was the second all-time highest monthly sales in Illinois, falling only behind the $144 million sold in December of 22. And there was no explanation from the Department of Financial and Professional Regulation, which gathers these data, whether or not it was somehow related with the strange weather that we're having, but who knows?
And Greg?
Tony Preckwinkle, the president of Cook County Board, has seen her influence really ramp up lately. She has a lot of her former staffers are in the Johnson administration, Mayor Johnson's administration. She clearly has a lot of influence there. Now we're about to find out how much influence she has as the party's boss. She's also the chairman of the Cook County Democratic Central Committee. They have slating this upcoming week, and there's two races that are drawing a lot of interest. State's attorney to succeed Kim Fox. Tony Preckwinkle has a candidate, but there's somebody else who also wants it. We'll see if she can swing it her way. And clerk of the circuit court in Cook County. When we see those votes, we'll see just how whether she also has the same amount of influence as a machine boss that she apparently has with Mr. Johnson.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. And our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Greg Hines with Crane Chicago Business, and Dave McKinney of WBEZ. Find our show where you get your podcasts through the NPR One app and at nprillinois.org. Just look for State Week. Join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.